Well, good morning, everybody. We've got Bio 241, and this is January 27th, Thursday, your second lecture this week. So we're going to have our second lecture on chemical composition of the body, and probably not finish a chapter today. I was just looking at the slides. Maybe finish, but we don't have to because we're scheduled for next time. But I want to make sure everybody knows, when is the test that's coming up? In a mere 2 weeks. Right, so 2 weeks from today. So if you haven't started studying yet, you really got to bust your butt over the weekend. Otherwise, you'll have no chance on the test, right? Okay, so to help you prepare for that test, you got all those online exercises, and you should be doing the pre-lecture reading assignments. So I think I'm going to start asking people to show me their pre-lecture reading assignments as you come in the room, just to make sure that you're staying on top of stuff. And it should make a huge difference in terms of what you're learning during lecture, because then you become familiar with terminology. And if I say a new word during lecture, if you've seen it already, it just doesn't go right over the top of your head. All right, so it's important to do those pre-lecture reading assignments. And in lab, you should take some time to talk about those if you have some questions. And if you have questions in lecture even, then you got to stop me during lecture and we can talk about it, if it's terminology or something. All right, so on the first test, it's chapters 1, 2, 3, and 6. And all of those modules are available in Blackboard. You can start working on them, so you know exactly what page numbers, figure numbers, all that kind of stuff. Okay, here's that periodic table that we were talking about last time. I'll have it projected on the screen. It seems a little bit dim for some reason. I'll have it projected on the screen, but I'll also give you a hard copy that you can have right at your desktop when you're taking the test. So you should kind of know a little bit about this periodic table. Like, for instance, this C right here, you got to know what that stands for. That stands for carbon, okay? But the other thing this periodic table tells you is how many protons are inside the nucleus of this carbon right here? Six, and that's called the atomic number, and that's right there. Plus, it also tells you how many shells of electrons this element has. What we have, here's one shell, here's a second, here's a third, here's a fourth, here's the fifth, right? So carbon has two shells, and it also tells you how electrons fill the shells up. The first shell has two electrons, right? So you don't even have to memorize this. Just understand how to read the periodic table. And then the next shell has eight, right? So then you got to remember how to fill the shells up. Okay. All right, well, let's talk about acids and bases a little bit. And since we're talking about elements, what kinds of things do you see in the nucleus of an atom? Protons and neutrons, exactly right. So here, let's just put a proton in the nucleus of this atom right here. And let's just say that that actually is the atomic number of this element. So what element is it that I drew on the board? Hydrogen. And hydrogen then will have one electron in an orbital, right? All right, so that's a hydrogen atom. And that hydrogen atom sometimes can get rid of this electron, so it won't have any kind of electron whatsoever. It's just going to be a free proton floating around in solution. And we know that that's what, a hydrogen atom, like you just said, and we also know that that's just a proton. So people use these terms interchangeably, a proton or hydrogen ion. And the way that we write a hydrogen ion on the board is like that, with a H+. That's a hydrogen ion. And what else could we call that? Yeah, that's a cation for sure, a monovalent cation. All right, so here is a hydrogen ion. And everybody kind of knows that it's a cation, so you could say a hydrogen, monovalent cation if you wanted to. You certainly could say that. Well, what's another term that you could use to describe this particle here, or this one right here? These things are exactly equal to each other. You could say that is a... Right, that is a proton. All right, so protons and hydrogen ions are exactly the same thing. A proton is what? A monovalent cation. And it just has one proton in the nucleus, no electrons. All right, so that's a little bit of an introduction to acids, bases, and the pH scale. Okay, acids are compounds that release protons, or what? Hydrogen ions into a solution. They're proton donors. So they just donate these kinds of that element to a solution. It's got to be a water solution, right? A base, on the other hand, is a chemical compound that lowers the hydrogen ion concentration in solution. So it accepts protons. It likes to gather up protons that are in solution. So those are some good definitions. So I got a couple examples right here of acids for you. Hydrochloric acid is a very strong acid. So if we got HCl and we put that in water, right, that's going to completely dissociate into hydrogen ions or protons plus chloride ions plus water. All right, so that HCl is going to completely come apart, and we have a hydrogen ion right here. So what do we call a compound like HCl that when we put it in water produces hydrogen ions or protons? That's an acid, right? That's the basic definition of an acid. And this is a strong acid because that happens 100%. If you put HCl in water, there won't be any of this compound left. It will always dissociate, break into those two particles. Other kinds of acids that are important in physiology are phosphoric acid and nitric acid, not so much, sulfuric acid, not so much, but carbonic acid. We're going to talk a lot about carbonic acid in here in the class, probably even today a little bit. So whenever you put carbonic acid in solution, these hydrogen ions like to break away and form protons that float around in solution. All right, a base, on the other hand, doesn't add protons to solution, but it adds hydroxide ions, an OH group. So any kind of compound that produces an OH, well, we got what? We got water right here. What's the overall charge on water? Zero. There's no net electrical charge. But if we break water down into hydroxide ions and hydrogen ions, okay, we can get this kind of situation right here. So any kind of compound that produces these hydroxide ions in solutions is a base. And if we put a base and acid together, so if we put compounds that put protons and hydroxide ions together, what happens? They will neutralize each other and make water. So it's a very convenient system to work with. Now, what happens to a lot of chemistry is when the hydrogen ion concentration, when this thing right here changes in water. So I'm going to put some brackets around it like that. When we put brackets around a chemical symbol like that, we just mean the concentration of that particular compound in water. So as the hydrogen ion concentration changes in water, that drastically changes the chemical properties and the chemical reactions that can take place. So we're going to be really interested in that because our body just basically runs on chemistry, chemical reactions. And the hydrogen ion concentration then will change chemical reactions in our body quite a bit. All right, so we want to be able to talk about the hydrogen ion concentration. And there is a term that we use to describe hydrogen ion concentration, and that is pH, a lowercase p and an uppercase h. That's just a symbol or a calculation for the hydrogen ion concentration in a solution, right? And the pH scale runs from 0 to 14, and you can have like 1.2 or 13.5. You can have decimal places right here. It's just not an integer number, right? But it only goes from 0 to 14. And the way that we calculate the pH of a solution is that we have to know the hydrogen ion concentration right here. Right, and now notice, look at the relationship with this equation. The pH is in the numerator, but what about the hydrogen ion concentration over on the right-hand side of this equation? Is it in the numerator or is it in the denominator? It's in the denominator, and so that means something just a little bit funny. It just means that there's an inverse relationship between pH and hydrogen ion concentration, which means that if the hydrogen ion concentration increases, what happens to the pH number if it's an inverse relationship? Yeah, it decreases. So it's not a directly related formula. So as hydrogen ion increases, the pH decreases. So the acidity of a solution, though, however, is directly related to the hydrogen ion concentration. As hydrogen ion concentration increases, the solution becomes more acidic. But the pH number does what? It goes down, because it's an inverse relationship. So this pH scale goes from 0 to 14. There's a number right smack in the middle. What number is right smack in the middle? That's a 7. 7 means that the pH is absolutely neutral. And what that means is that when it's neutral at pH 7, the concentration of hydrogen ions right here, is exactly equal to hydroxide ions, just like that. They got to be exactly equal. In the next table on the next slide, I'll show that to you again. Okay, so that if those ions would combine with each other, they would just form water. All right, so that's a pH 7. That is, pH 7 is neither acidic nor basic. And that's what it says right here. Pure water is neutral, has a pH of 7. As the hydrogen ion concentration increases, right, then the solution becomes more acidic and the pH number decreases. It gets smaller than 7, goes to 6.5, then 6, then 5, and the most acidic it can be is 0. All right, so a pH of 1 is much more acidic than a pH of 5. If you haven't worked with pH, then you just kind of have to get used to that scale a little bit because of that inverse relationship. On the other hand, if the pH is greater than 7, it is basic, right? And that goes from pH 7 to 14. Okay, and this is how you would calculate the pH with your calculator. Okay, and I'll maybe ask you to do that on a test. And there's some quantitative questions, so you got to have your basic scientific calculator. And the easiest way to calculate pH is for you, if someone gives you the hydrogen ion concentration, is type the hydrogen ion concentration in your calculator, take the inverse of it, and then push the log button. It's just as easy as that, and then you get the pH number automatically. Okay, so there are different ways of doing that, because with logs, sometimes you can say that this is actually true right here. What do we have? We have log 1 over the hydrogen ion. Oh, what do these little brackets mean right here? Concentration, right? This is exactly the same as, I'm running into that little marker right there. This is exactly the same as minus the log of the hydrogen ion concentration. Because that's how logs operate when you have something in the denominator right there. But you probably don't even have to do that, right? Just take the hydrogen ion concentration, take the inverse of it, and then the log, and then that will give you the pH. Okay, so here is a table. And you can see we have the hydrogen ion concentration in a molar solution. And right here, when the pH is neutral, okay, the concentration is 1 times 10 to the minus 7th particles in a liter of hydrogen ions. And if you plug this number into our formula right there, you get a pH of 7. And we also said that at a pH of 7, what's the relationship between the hydrogen ion concentration and the hydroxide ion concentration? They're exactly equal. So if we look across over here at pH 7, 10 to the minus 7 for hydrogen ion, and so the concentration of hydroxide ions is going to be 10 to the minus 7th as well. Exactly equal. So this is exactly equal. As the solution becomes more basic, look, the concentration of hydrogen ions decrease, but what about the concentration of hydroxide ions? It increases. It goes the opposite way. And as the solution becomes more acidic, it becomes way more concentrated in hydrogen ions and less concentrated in hydroxide ions. All right, so the funny thing you got to remember, as a water solution becomes more acidic, okay, becoming more acidic as we go up this column, what happens to the pH number? It goes 14, 13, 12, it becomes less because of that inverse relationship on the previous slide. Okay, so pH in our bodies is, I'm going to come back to that slide in just a second. pH is a physiologic parameter that is controlled, it's regulated in your body. It can go up and down just a little bit, but it has to stay within a normal range. And what do we say that when something does stay within a normal range? What's being maintained? Homeostasis. That's exactly right. So now this range is a very small range, 7.35 to 7.45. Now if you look at these numbers right here, 7.35, what does that say? Is it neutral or is it acidic or is it basic? It's a little bit basic. It's not a whole lot of basic, but it's just a little bit basic. All right, so this is for blood. Other tissues might be a little bit more acidic depending on levels of exercise and things like that. Okay, but if somebody, for instance, has a pH of 7.45 and then in just a matter of an hour, their pH goes to 7.6, for instance. Does that seem like a big change, 7.4 to 7.6? Some of you might say, oh, that's not a very big change. I mean, it could go all the way to 14, right? This is just a tenth of a decimal point change. But if it were to change, that probably would be fatal, right? So very small changes in pH, right, can have drastic consequences on our physiology. All right, and pH in our body is maintained by buffering actions of various kinds of chemicals, and we're going to talk about that next. All right, acidosis is a condition when the pH drops below 7.35. What does that mean? Becoming more basic or acidic? Yeah, becoming more acidic. When that number decreases, when the pH number decreases, it becomes more acidic. That could be due to metabolism, and we would call that a metabolic acidosis when that happens. Or your body could become more basic, and we would call that an alkalosis. And that could be due to metabolism, and we would call that a metabolic alkalosis. Or it could even be due to breathing patterns, and that would be a respiratory alkalosis. So even breathing patterns can change the pH of your body, right? If you become more basic, if your blood becomes more basic, then that pH number goes above 7.45. So this number is tightly regulated. Now, does anybody know the pH of Coca-Cola, for instance, a soft drink? I don't have it on the tip of my tongue. We could Google it, but it's probably about a pH of 1.5 to maybe 2. So what does that say? It's neutral or what? It's extremely acidic, right? And what happens to somebody if they go to the 7-Eleven and get a big Slurpee, you know, 25 ounces of Coke, and it's all very acidic like that, and drink it, what's going to happen to them? Do you know of anybody just to keel over due to a metabolic acidosis because they drank too much Coca-Cola? I have never heard of that. But you might wonder, well, why doesn't that happen? All right, and other things, we eat a lot of acids in our, for instance, when we ever have a salad with salad dressing and it's loaded with acetic acid, that's about a pH of 2, very acidic as well. So how come we don't die of acidosis when we eat acids? And that's because our bodies are loaded with buffers and other kinds of control mechanisms that control pH for us so that our body pH does not change. All right, so buffers are extremely important. They're molecules that prevent changes in pH. It says slow changes. They actually prevent changes in pH, all right, when either an acid or a base is added to solution. And it's not that a buffer is going to maintain a pH of 7, but a buffer, different buffers can maintain different pHs depending on what the compound really is. Right? In our body, it's going to maintain a pH of about what? 7.35, 7.4, something like that. So that if you add protons to solution or hydroxide ions to your body, your pH is not going to change because buffers basically gobble these things up. They take it out of solution. That's what they have to do. Okay, so a buffer doesn't maintain a pH of 7, it just prevents a change in pH of whatever the system is. A very important buffer in your body is the bicarbonate buffer system that's in blood. And the bicarbonate buffer system is built around this carbonic acid molecule right here. And when I was typing the slide up, I might not have had my glasses on because I've got C02 right here. And that should really be what? CO2. Okay, but it kind of looks like an O anyway. Maybe you wouldn't even notice that. All right, now, carbonic acid can change in a couple different ways. If we move to the left, carbonic acid can dissociate to form carbon dioxide and water. Okay, and are you familiar with when you breathe, exhale from your body, you're excreting a lot of carbon dioxide because it's a metabolic waste product. All right, so you exhale, you excrete carbon dioxide. And the other thing that carbonic acid can do is that it can actually dissociate the other way. It can form bicarbonate ion and hydrogen ion right here. Because it's an acid, it can actually donate hydrogen ions to solution. So here is an important chemical principle. If you look at these arrows right here, does it look like a one-way street? It looks like a two-way street. So this reaction can go to the right or it can go to the left. And you might be asking, well, why does it go one way or the other? And the reason why it goes one way or the other is by there's a balance based on the concentration of these different compounds right here. So if the concentration of carbon dioxide increases, that favors the reaction to move to the right, all the way to the right. As carbon dioxide increases in your body is going to produce carbonic acid. And as carbonic acid concentration increases, then it's going to produce bicarbonate and hydrogen ions right here. So your body is going to become, what happens when hydrogen ion concentration increases in a solution? Does the pH change? Yes, absolutely, it becomes more acidic. So when carbon dioxide concentration increases in your body, it becomes more acidic. And maybe this gives you a little bit of a foreshadowing. If you start to hyperventilate, what does that mean? You speed up your respiratory rate. When that happens, that releases a lot of CO2 from your body, okay? And as the concentration of CO2 decreases, then the reaction has a tendency to go to the left. And so hydrogen ion will combine with bicarbonate. And what happens to the pH of your body then as this hydrogen ion goes away? It becomes more basic. And so then it forms carbonic acid, and then carbonic acid dissociates into carbon dioxide, and you breathe that out of your body. So just by changing your respiratory patterns can change the pH of your body. So this principle where if we have a chemical reaction that can go in both directions, right, we call that the law of mass action, or Le Chatelier's principle. So you have to be a little bit familiar with that. So which way would this chemical reaction go, to the right or to the left, if we increase the concentration of bicarbonate ion right here? If we increase bicarbonate, which way is the chemical reaction going to be forced to go? It's going to go to the left, right? Or if we decrease the bicarbonate ion concentration, which way is this reaction going to go? It's going to be forced to the right, and that's the law of mass action. So this bicarbonate right here is in your body, and when you drink Coca-Cola, it dumps a lot of these hydrogen ions into solution, but that's not such a big deal because what's going to happen? It's going to combine with bicarbonate, which then is going to force the reaction to the left. You're going to produce CO2, and then you'll just, right, excrete carbon dioxide, and your body is not, the pH of your body is not going to change as a result of that. So that's just a pretty fancy buffer. And there are many buffers in your body, not just bicarbonate. This is just one important one because we're always producing CO2. But every protein, have you ever heard of a protein? What's a building block of a protein? Anybody know? Amino acid, maybe you've kind of heard that along the way somewhere. We're going to talk about that. But every protein is a buffer as well. And phosphate is a buffer. We have a lot of phosphoric acid in our body. Inorganic phosphate, that's a buffer system as well. So if the pH of our body changes, that really means that there's something drastic happening, okay, because we have so many buffers to take care of it for us. Okay, so this reaction, it says right here, can go in either direction depending on the concentration. All right, so we talked about that slide already. So that's pH. Maybe people are just running into pH for the first time, so let me draw something quickly on the board. Let's take a beaker. As a matter of fact, let's take three beakers. What is the pH scale run through? What are possible numbers for pH scale? 0 to 14, right? And what's absolutely neutral? 7, right. Okay, so here we have a beaker, and we got water in there. We got some hydrogen ions, like this. What's another name for a hydrogen ion? A proton, right? And of course, then we've got some water in there and maybe one hydroxide ion like that, but mostly protons in solution, just like that, hydrogen ion. Is that a neutral solution or an acidic solution or a basic solution? It's acidic because it's loaded with hydrogen ions, right? So here is a very acidic solution. And what is the pH going to be? Okay, it's going to be less than 7. That's all you can say. Okay, because I didn't really give you a concentration. If I gave you a concentration and you had your calculator handy, then voila, you could tell me the pH. All right, let's look at this beaker over here. All right, so let's put some ions in here as well, just like this. And of course, it's got to be a water solution. All right. Now, is this acidic or basic? We got to count. What do we got? 1, 2, 3 hydroxide ions and 1, 2, 3 hydrogen ions. Exactly equal concentration. So you could tell me the exact pH number right there. It's pH 7. All right, so pH 7, which means that pH 7 means that it's absolutely neutral. The hydrogen ions, hydroxide ions exactly balance out. And then on the other hand, we got some water over here. All right, so I'm sure you see where I'm going with this. All right, so far, is that an acidic solution or a basic solution? Basic. And now what? More basic. And now what? More basic. Well, we can put a little hydrogen ion, maybe not quite so basic, and some water. So now the pH of this solution is going to be what? Greater than 7. It's going to be basic. All right. All right, so as the hydrogen ion concentration increases in solution, what happens to the acidity? It goes up. Acidity goes up, but what about the pH number? Now that goes down. It's a tongue twister. I know, you really got to think of that. Okay, because why? It's an inverse relationship because of the algebraic formula that we use. Okay. So does anybody have a question on that? I have to be thinking really clearly to tell you about pH, and I'm not sure I'm thinking clearly yet this morning. So hopefully you guys know what I was talking about, right? Okay. So it's a little bit of a tongue twister. You got to think about that. But you got that table, and if you're not sure, if you look at the numbers in that table, go ahead and make a graph. Plot these things out, and you'll see hydrogen ions increasing, pH decreasing. You could go ahead and do that. Okay, let's talk about some organic molecules, and you could actually replace this maybe with some biological molecules, right? Organic or biological molecules are not necessarily the same. All right, so let me tell you something about an organic molecule. And organic molecules are those that contain a carbon atom. And we see over here, here's that carbon atom, right? That's got 6 protons inside the nucleus. That carbon atom has to be covalently bound to hydrogen in order for it to be an organic compound. And so what does a covalent bond mean? Is it a weak bond or kind of middle of the road or strong? Strong. And what are happening to electrons there? They're being shared. Really good. I'm glad you guys know that. Okay. All right. So for instance, let me draw a couple molecules, compounds on the board. So an organic compound can't be just a carbon atom, right? That's just a carbon atom. It's got to be a compound, covalently bound. So there is an important molecule that we just talked about, namely CO2. Is that an organic compound? Okay, some people say, well, that's really important biologically in us. Our body produces it. Gee whiz, it must be an organic compound. But it's not according to the definition, because you got to have both a carbon and a hydrogen that are sharing electrons, and that's not happening in this circumstance. Okay, what about H2O? Important biological molecule, would you agree? But is it organic? It certainly is not organic, right? And here is a molecule of carbon with a hydrogen here and a hydrogen here and a hydrogen here. This is methane, okay? For us, it's not terribly important unless we have a malabsorption syndrome or something and we're producing a lot of gas. But typically, now, is this an organic compound, even though it's not really important to our biology? Sure is, because we got carbon and hydrogen right here. Okay, let's go back to when we were talking about covalent bonds. There were two kinds of covalent bonds that can form, polar covalent bonds and nonpolar covalent bonds. All right, can anybody remember a nonpolar covalent bond? Okay, it's like what we have right here. Now, this hydrogen has to be bound to what element for it to be a polar covalent bond? There are 4 atoms. Okay, so if there is a nitrogen bound to a hydrogen, or, so I'll just put a comma right here, or we've got oxygen bound to a hydrogen, or sulfur, oh, we're doing really good, bound to a hydrogen, or nitrogen, oh, guess what, there's 5. Oh, we did nitrogen? Oh, we did nitrogen, okay, 4, good. Okay, phosphorus bound to a hydrogen. Okay, so why do we say polar covalent bonds in this circumstance? Because nitrogen, oxygen, sulfur, and phosphorus have a tendency to take the electron from hydrogen right, and just sequester it in its orbital. It doesn't like to really share it. It's still sharing it, but not really. So this end of the molecule ends up with a what? A little positive charge right here. And these end up a little bit more negative. Okay. So, fluorine, I think, works as well. But it's not really an important biological compound for us. Okay. So I'm just kind of sticking to human physiology a little bit. Now, pharmacology, you're probably interested in that. All right, so here are some organic compounds. Let's look at this. This is a hydrocarbon, because here's hydrogen and carbon. That's all I see in this molecule right here. So this definitely is a nice organic molecule. We call it hexane because it's got six carbons right here. And every carbon has either got a hydrogen or a carbon bound to it. And is this, are we going to call this a polar molecule or a nonpolar molecule? Okay, because all of these bonds right here are what? Nonpolar covalent bonds. And what kind of solution is water? Is it a polar solution or a nonpolar? The water molecule, does it have polarity or no polarity? Remember we drew it out last time? Because we've got oxygen, okay, bound to hydrogen. What kind of covalent bonds are those? Polar, right? So this end of the water molecule is a little bit positive. This end right here is a little bit negative. So water is a polar compound. Polar substances like to dissolve in water because it's a polar compound. But now we have hexane right here that's nonpolar, and this thing just hates water. It is hydrophobic because it has no polar covalent bonds, only nonpolar covalent bonds. Nonetheless, our body is made up of this kind of backbone, a carbon backbone, just like this. Okay, so hexane, not important, but it's just for teaching purposes. This carbon backbone molecule, because it's really long, likes to form a ring, right? It can bend back on itself and form a ring and becomes really stable, right? And again, we just see carbon-hydrogen bonds. So this is, instead of hexane, this is cyclohexane. Now, is this going to dissolve in water? What kind of bonds do we have right here? Okay, yeah, we have some double bonds, but let's just think in terms of polarity or nonpolar. Polar or nonpolar? Still nonpolar. So does cyclohexane like to dissolve in water? No, because it's a nonpolar compound. And then here is benzene that forms some double bonds, and maybe an SI or something, you can see how to form double bonds, covalent bonds, by working with your orbital theory if you're interested in doing that. But again, we only see carbon-hydrogen bonds right here, which are what? Nonpolar bonds. So even this benzene ring does not like to dissolve in water. Okay, but these positions where we have hydrogen, we can place substitutions with other kinds of compounds, different functional groups, right? And so if we change the structure of this chemical compound, guess what's going to happen to it? The function and how it behaves in the world is going to change as well. So we're going to substitute various kinds of functional groups in these positions on some of these molecules. Okay, so here we have a whole bunch of organic molecules, right? And what's an organic molecule again? It's got to have a carbon and a hydrogen bound to it covalently. And so here is a five-carbon chain. And when I just have a solid line right there, that just means that there's a hydrogen here. That's just a short form of writing hydrogen. But in the middle carbon position, right, we have two bonds, but it's not to a hydrogen. It's just a double bond to an oxygen molecule. All right, and that's what we call a carbonyl group. And so when we change the structure of this carbon backbone, guess what happens? The function is going to change. All right, so I do want you to know this is a carbonyl group right here. Or sometimes we can put an OH group on one side and an H on the other. We have a hydroxyl group right here. Okay, again, now that's going to change the function because we have a hydrogen bound to an oxygen. What's that going to allow this part of the molecule to do? What kind of covalent bond is OH, the OH bond? What is that? Ah, right here, that's a polar kind of bond. So now that part of the molecule would like to be around water and the other part's not. Okay, so we see that we're starting to change the function a little bit. So this is forming an alcohol. This hydroxyl group is forming an alcohol. Here's a sulfhydryl group. What does that S stand for? sulfur. And what kind of bond is this SH bond right here? Polar or nonpolar? That's polar. So now it starts to interact more with how our systems are dissolved in water, right? It can, this N can interact with water again. Here is an amino group, an NH2. You've kind of heard of an amino group before. In what sense? As a matter of fact, you all told me just a couple minutes ago. You said something about an amino acid. So an amino acid has to have a group something like this on it. Okay? And then on the end, if there's a CO2 with an H, CO2H, this is what we call a carboxyl group. And this is a very acidic group because when this compound gets put in water, this hydrogen right here, not only is it polar, so it can dissolve in water, it likes to hop off. What do we call a compound that when we put it in water, protons like to hop off of it? What do we call that kind of compound? Something that donates hydrogen ions to solution when it gets dissolved in water. What do we call that compound? That's an acid. So a carboxyl group is an acid, right? So that's a highly reactive group. And then here's a phosphate group. And guess what? This is a nice polar group right here. But even now, these hydrogens like to hop off of the oxygen. And so a phosphate group is acidic as well because it can donate hydrogen ions to solution. So phosphate groups and carboxyl groups form a class of compounds that we call organic acids. Right, and these are organic compounds because here is that nice carbon-hydrogen bond. All right, so these structures I do want you to know and the name of them as well. We're going to practice them maybe not today, but maybe next time. Okay, there's a nice flash quiz for you. All right, so those are organic compounds. All the important biological molecules that we're going to look at in this next discussion right here are organic compounds. And there are four general classes. There's carbohydrates. Anybody know what another name for a carbohydrate could be? Yes, you're right. Sugar. Okay, sugars or saccharides or polysaccharides. So carbohydrates are sugar, and we're going to see how that name came up. So carbohydrates is one. Lipids are another class of important biological molecules that we're going to look at. So we got sugars, lipids. And then we got proteins. We talked about those a little bit already. And then the last one will be things like nucleic acids, DNA and RNA. So we got sugars, proteins, lipids, and nucleic acids. So we're going to look at some of these compounds. And you're going to see some nice themes between these things. All right, so carbohydrates. Here is the carbon backbone that we were just looking at. But notice this carbon right here doesn't have two hydrogens. It's got what? A hydroxyl group. All right, so what can you tell me about some of the properties of this carbon, this hydrocarbon right here? Does it like to dissolve in water or not? Yeah, because all of these OH groups right here are polar covalent bonds. So if you take some sugar and put it in water, a ton of it is going to dissolve in water because of all of these polar covalent bonds. Plus, right, this little aldehyde group right here, this carbonyl group, will allow it to dissolve in water as well. And this is glucose. Glucose has six carbons in it. And what do these long chains of carbons like to do? They like to form ring structures, like cyclohexane that we saw before. So here is a sugar molecule that has formed a ring structure. Here's another sugar called galactose. It still has six carbons, but it's a, what we call an isomer. Oxygen is going to be on different sides of the molecule depending on what position it's bound to the carbon backbone. And then here is fructose. Fructose is a six-carbon sugar. And now the carbonyl group is moved to the second carbon instead of the first carbon. So it has six carbons, but again, its function is just a little bit different because it has a little bit different structure. Now, on a test, I don't want you to be able to tell me the difference between glucose and galactose and fructose. Sooner or later, you're going to be really familiar that these are six-carbon sugars. These are all six-carbon sugars. But what I do want you to tell me, if you see something on the test that's like this or like this ring structure over here, you got to tell me that it's a carbohydrate and in particular that it is a monosaccharide. Or, yeah, it's a sugar. It's a simple sugar, a monosaccharide. Each one of these is just one sugar, right? Mono just means one. Okay. So we'll practice that too. All right. So how does something become a carbohydrate or sugar? It's got to have the the correct ratio of carbons to hydrogens and oxygens. So for every carbon atom, there's got to be one oxygen atom. And for every carbon, there's got to be two hydrogens, right? And so what does H2O look like right here? Water. And so that's how people came up with this name. Carbohydrates are what? Carbon hydrates. They're just carbons that have basically a water molecule substituted in a couple of different locations. So that's how they came up with that name. All right, so these are all just monosaccharides. Okay, so a disaccharide is when you join two monosaccharides together by a covalent bond. And here are some important disaccharides. Table sugar is what we call sucrose. It's got a glucose bound with a fructose. Right, and fructose is a fruit sugar, so that's sucrose. Lactose or milk sugar has a glucose and a galactose bound together. Right, and that's a different kind of bond because these galactose has a different structure than fructose, right? So here's this is what fructose looks like. This is what galactose looks like. So the structure is different. You need a different kind of enzyme to break lactose down into its basic monosaccharides right here. And as we get older, most of us lose that enzyme, and so we can't digest lactose if it's in our diet. Just a little fun nomenclature right here. We're going to talk about enzymes and nomenclature. The enzyme that breaks lactose, which is a sugar, down into two monosaccharides is given the name lactase. So that's really nice and easy. We just put an A right here in this position. So lactase will break lactose down into these monosaccharides. And we all pretty much lose that enzyme as we get older. And then that lactose is stuck in our digestive tract, and it goes places and it causes interesting things to happen, which maybe we'll talk about later. Okay, maltose, on the other hand, is just two glucoses. All right? So these are all what we call disaccharides. So not only can we make disaccharides, but we can make polysaccharides. All right? Polysaccharides are just polymers of these monosaccharides joined together, and it could be a trisaccharide. So a polysaccharide could be a trisaccharide, or there could be thousands of molecules of glucose put together. That's going to be a polysaccharide. They're all going to be linked together. And as a matter of fact, if we take thousands of molecules of glucose and put it together, in plants, they put it together in a certain way. We call that starch. And animals put it together in a little bit different way, a little bit different branching pattern. We call that glycogen. But nonetheless, both starch and glycogen are storage forms for glucose. They're pure glucose, basically. So whenever you eat wheat or corn or flour in a tortilla or whatever, basically, what are you eating? Yeah, you're just basically eating a candy bar. It's just made out of glucose. That's all there's to it. So diabetics do have to be concerned about their starch intake, right? Because it is really sugar, even though it doesn't taste sweet, because it's in the form of a polymer. Okay. So starch and glycogen are important energy storage molecules because there's a lot of energy in glucose. And this just allows organisms to store thousands of these glucose particles without causing osmotic problems. I don't know if you really know. We'll talk about osmosis and osmotic pressure in just a little bit. But for instance, have you ever had like a bowl of sugar or a bowl of salt or something, and you take a look at that bowl, and you poured it into the bowl, it was all just nice granules, and you came back a day later and it's kind of all annealed together because maybe it was really humid outside. It hardly gets humid here in L.A., but maybe you're down by the ocean or something, and it just absorbed a lot of water, okay? So whenever you have something that's very salty or a lot of glucose, it absorbs water. So if you have thousands of particles of glucose in a cell, it's going to have a tendency to absorb water or osmose water into the cell. And as water enters, guess what happens to the cell? It starts to swell up. Okay, but if you take all those thousands of molecules of glucose and just make one molecule of glycogen out of it, then it won't absorb that water, and what's going to happen to the cell? It's going to stay the same shape, right? Which is basically what you want to do right now. None of you want to swell up to 10 times the size that you should be. You want to stay the same kind of shape. So this is a way for your body to store thousands and thousands of molecules of glucose without changing the shape of the cell or the water balance inside of a cell. That's what we mean by osmotic problems. Okay. All right, so how do we form these disaccharides? So here's the glucose and here's the glucose. Okay, and on each position of this carbon right here, we have an H and OH because that's a nice carbohydrate. These two molecules bump into each other in just a certain way that we see the H highlighted and the OH on another glucose highlighted, and we can put these two together and get what?
Water.
Okay, so this is now going to form a nice covalent link bond between them. We have the oxygen atom left and water comes out. We call this a dehydration synthesis reaction or a condensation reaction. Very typical kind of reaction. This also shows that not only is water the solvent that our body is dissolved in, it also participates in many important chemical reactions in our body. It's a fascinating kind of molecule in that sense. All right, so that's how your body can make maltose, or here's a good example on how to make sucrose. And sucrose is just what? A glucose and a fructose joined together with an OH and an H from fructose. That water molecule comes out, and now we have a nice covalent bond binding these two monosaccharides together to make what? A disaccharide, right? A nice disaccharide, specific name is sucrose, via what kind of chemical reaction? A dehydration synthesis or condensation reaction, okay, by pulling water out. And you're going to see that that's an important theme for you to realize. All right, or we could have a little bit more complicated kind of sugar like maltose, and we can go the reverse way with the correct enzyme. That enzyme can bind the water and maltose. It will split the water and then put the split water on either end of the maltose molecule. Right, and so this reaction, if we're going in the reverse direction, is called a dehydrolysis or hydrolysis reaction. All right, so monosaccharides can be used to make polysaccharides with a dehydration synthesis, or polysaccharides can be broken down into simpler sugars with what? A hydrolysis reaction. So that's really pretty good. So what do I want you to recognize? Make sure you know those two reactions, something about glycogen and starch, and be able to recognize these chemical compounds right here. Okay. So that's for carbohydrates. And now you kind of see also why carbohydrates are named the way they are. All right, here's a sign-in sheet. Ooh, sign-in sheet. We've got to pass this around. I do have to look at a couple things. If you still have some friends that are trying to add the class, I looked at all the labs this morning, and it looks like all the labs are full. So it doesn't look like we'll be able to add anybody else in the class, right? There might be a possibility at the 1 o'clock class today and on Tuesday, but it's probably pretty slim. If your name's on this list, that's because this is still from opening day. So go ahead and sign it even on the back, even if your name isn't on there. All right, so we're done with carbohydrates. That means we're going to talk about lipids right now, or fats. All right, what do we know about the property of sugars or carbohydrates in terms of dissolving in water? Are they hydrophilic or hydrophobic?
Hydrophilic
because they're loaded with these polar covalent bonds right here, oxygen, hydrogen, polar covalent bonds. All right, and so we're going to contrast this a little bit with lipids. Lipids are insoluble in polar solvents such as water, so we call those compounds hydrophobic. They consist primarily of just hydrocarbon chains or rings without many substitutions with sulfur or phosphorus, right? There's some that might, and we're going to take a special look at those. Okay, so here we have, let's just look at this molecule right here. It's a nice organic molecule, right? So we got carbon and hydrogen. It's got a carboxyl group, which makes it nice and reactive. So this is an acid. And this part is really fatty, right? There's no polar covalent bonds anywhere, so it doesn't like to dissolve in water. So this is what we call a fatty acid. This is the fatty part. Here is the acid right here. And that hydrogen just likes to hop off. And we can take three of these fatty acids and combine it with another molecule that we call glycerol. Glycerol has three carbon atoms. And guess where you could get two glycerols from? If we break a certain molecule in half. Which one had six carbons that we were thinking about so far? Like glucose has six carbons, right? We could break a glucose in half and guess what we're going to get? All right, something really close to two glycerols right here. And look, glycerol has these carbon hydroxyl groups right here, so glycerol likes to dissolve in water, right? But these fatty acids don't necessarily really like to, except this group over here will help it. So the glycerol can bind three fatty acids, and when it does, via a dehydration synthesis reaction producing three water molecules, it's going to produce something that we call a triglyceride, right? Because glycerol was one of the molecules used to form triglyceride with these three fatty acids. Had anybody ever had their blood taken to look at the triglycerides in their blood? Probably. It's a very common blood test, right? So here is the form of a triglyceride, and it's called a glyceride because the backbone is a glycerol molecule. All right, so what do we call this reaction that makes a triglyceride from three fatty acids and a glycerol molecule? Condensation, or another term could be dehydration synthesis reaction, right? So nature didn't have to invent a whole new series of reactions to make other interesting lipid compounds compared to polysaccharides. The same reaction works, right? Your body can make very interesting polymers out of the same reaction, namely dehydration synthesis or condensation. And guess what? This reaction can go backwards as well. And what would we call that? Oh, I don't have it here, but let's imagine that it's right here. Put this arrow backwards. What would we call it if we have a triglyceride, add three waters to it, and end up with three fatty acids and a glycerol molecule? That's a hydrolysis reaction. Okay. So I do want you to be able to recognize this thing as being a fatty acid and this thing right here as being a glycerol molecule. All right, so maybe you have to draw it out maybe just a couple times. I won't ask you to draw it out on the test, but if you see three carbons with these three hydroxyl groups on it, that's a glycerol molecule. That's a pretty important intermediate. All right, so here is really what a fatty acid looks like. Previous slide was truncated a little bit. All right. So here is just a long hydrocarbon chain with a carboxyl group. So here's the fatty part, here's the acid part, so hence fatty acid. There is a single bond in the backbone between every single carbon. We call this a saturated fatty acid because at every carbon in the fatty backbone of the molecule, there are two hydrogens. It's completely saturated with hydrogens. That's what we mean by a saturated fatty acid. And this particular one, if you count the number of carbons, is palmitic acid. All right. Every once in a while, we're going to run into fatty acids that have, instead of every carbon having two hydrogens, might form a double bond between the carbon backbones, which means you can't have it bound to another hydrogen right here. This is what we call an unsaturated fatty acid. And that's going to put some kinks and bends. It's going to change the structure. Instead of a nice linear structure, it's going to put some kinks and bends in this fatty acid. So the fate of these fatty acids, how it's dealt in the body and what kind of structures they make will be different because their structure is different, which means then that their physiology is going to be different as well. Okay, and these certainly are really important for dietitians and have been in the news lately. Okay, so fatty acids and another compound are needed to make a triglyceride. What are the building blocks of a triglyceride again? It's always good to be able to break things down into building blocks. What are the building blocks of a triglyceride? Okay, triglyceride. How many fatty acids? Three fatty acids and a glycerol molecule. Okay, three fatty acids and a glycerol. Because, why is that? Because glycerol has three carbons. I'm not going to draw the whole thing. It's got three carbons with an OH here, right? An OH here and an OH here. And so this carbon can bind a fatty acid, this one can bind one fatty acid, and this one can bind one fatty acid by what? A dehydration synthesis reaction. Okay, so three fatty acids on one glycerol molecule. Okay. All right, so this takes us to one of the most fascinating molecules in your body, and that is a phospholipid. Okay, so a phospholipid, what does a lipid mean? Lipid just means hydrocarbon, right? Can't dissolve in water, okay, but a phospholipid is kind of interesting because what do you know about phosphate? It makes polar covalent bonds, which means that it can dissolve in water. So what is a phospholipid? We've got to start with glycerol. How many carbons does glycerol have? Three, so here you got one, two, three. Here's the glycerol molecule right here on carbon one and carbon two. It has been bound to via dehydration synthesis to a nice fatty acid. A fatty acid in the second location right here, which means that this part of the molecule likes to dissolve in oil, right? And let's look at the third carbon right here. Something fancy took place. Instead of a fatty acid being bound, what do we have? A phosphate and a nitrogen group right here. This is, sometimes we call this a phosphatidyl group right here. But what can you tell me about phosphate and this nitrogen? Oh, and all these oxygens. And here, this oxygen has lost a hydrogen, so it even has a little bit of a negative charge. So this end of the molecule is what? Hydrophilic or hydrophobic? It's hydrophilic. So one end is hydrophobic, the other end is hydrophilic. So this is a really special molecule called a phospholipid. Here's that phosphate group on the glycerol background bone, and here are the, and don't forget, these are really long hydrocarbon tails, right? The fatty acids are really, really long. Phospholipid. And we can diagram it as just a sphere right here representing the hydrophilic part, and this part over here being the hydrophobic part of the molecule. All right, so why are we fascinated with this molecule right here? Because it likes to be in both domains of the world. Both the fatty domain, say that again.
The cell membrane.
Yeah, it's going to make something called a cell membrane. Because maybe when you took anatomy or some other classes, that's the basic description of a membrane is what? A phospholipid bilayer. Okay, maybe that's coming to mind. All right, but let's play around, just have a little fun with this molecule. Okay. Okay, so here we have, my pen kind of ran out. Here we have, what do we have right here? There's a nice little plug in the top. Here we have a jar, but it's a salad dressing bottle. Okay, I'm sure you recognize that now. Here's a salad dressing bottle. Okay, and it's in the refrigerator. And when you look at it in the refrigerator, right, it's got stuff in there, but the stuff is organized. Is that right? Do you ever recognize that it's organized? It's got two main layers. What are the two main layers? There's a top layer and a bottom. What's in the top? That's the oil part, okay? And then down over here is the water part with all the spices and salts and good tasting stuff, right? And now, before you put it in the refrigerator, did you do anything special to make sure that the oil was up on the top and the water was down at the bottom? It just kind of happened automatically, right? Okay. Now, before you put this on your salad, what do you want to do? Just pour the oil out on your salad? No, you got to shake it up, right? You want to mix it all together. Okay. So, but let's go back to this condition where the oil is separated and from the water down over here. And then let's put this molecule in there. What is this thing right here? What is that? That is on this slide over here. That's a phospholipid, right? So here is, what end of the molecule is this? This is the? That's the phyllic part, and this one right here is the phobic part, hydrophobic part. So if we take this one molecule and throw it in the bottle, and we come back a day later, and we want to find that molecule, where are we going to find it? Is it going to be up over here? Is it going to be up down over here? Where is it going to be? It's going to be exactly right here in this meniscus between the oil and the salt. And in particular, which way is it going to be? Where is this hydrophilic head group going to be? That's a head group because it kind of looks, it's going to be down like that. All right. And where are these tails going to be? They're going to be pointing up just like that. And did you have to do anything special to get that molecule exactly right there? No, it just happens automatically by the basic natures or the fundamental natures of that molecule, right? Okay. Well, instead of one molecule, let's have 1,000 of these and put it in the salad dressing bottle, and what's going to happen? They're all going to orient exactly just like that, right? The head groups are going to be down in the water just like that, and the tails are going to be poking up just like this, okay? And then if we forget about the salad dressing bottle, right? I mean, it's still there, but just kind of forget that it's really there like that. Okay, and we look at this structure right here, that should remind you of something. What does that look like? That looks like a membrane, a cell membrane. So cell membranes, because of the phospholipid properties, have an ability to self-assemble. And a cell membrane is one of the important three structures that are necessary to define what life is. Okay, so if something's alive, it's got to be made out of cells. And what are the three basic components that a cell has to have to be a cell? It's got to have a cell membrane. which automatically assembles itself just like that, magically. It's got to have genetic material on the inside, and it's got to have cytoplasm. Right? So life, one of the essential structures for life, has an ability to just make itself up from these molecules. That's pretty fascinating, I think. All right, so phospholipids, you got to be really familiar with. That's a structure for a test that you got to be able to recognize, right? And probably you should be able to analyze this molecule and say, whoa, here's a nice glycerol backbone. Here are some fatty acids. Here's the phosphate head group. And, of course, if you see something like this, then you got to know this is a phospholipid as well, okay? Okay. So lipids can be pretty important and interesting. So here we have a bunch of phospholipids. All of these hydrocarbon tails we see are pointing into the center because they like each other. These are all hydrophobic compounds, right? So they like to associate with other hydrophobic compounds. The phosphate head group right here likes to associate with water because it has charges and it has polar covalent bonds, so it can form hydration shells. So this structure right here actually kind of looks like a cell because it's forming this membrane, but we call that a micelle. It's not quite at the level of a cell because it doesn't have cytoplasm or genetic material. Okay. So phospholipids can aggregate to form micelles. And this compound right here, we're going to talk about surfactants a little bit later on. I'm not going to talk about that right now. Okay, other kinds of lipids that I want you to be able to recognize are things that we call steroids. And when I look at this molecule right here, it kind of looks like steps in a room that we have over here, right? So here's the first step, here's the second step, here's the third step, kind of looks like a staircase a little bit. Mostly, I don't see any oxygen or hydrogen bonds in here. They're just hydrocarbons. So this basic molecule, except for this hydroxyl group way over here, is mostly what? Just a hydrophobic molecule, does not like to dissolve in water. So steroids generally really hate water. They like to dissolve in oil, right? Or maybe the inside part of a membrane, because that's where the fatty acids part of a phospholipid are, right? Or if they're going to be dissolved in blood, they have to have some kind of carrier molecule that carries them through blood, because blood is a watery solution. All right, so whenever you see this kind of structure, you're going to think steroids. Some important kinds of steroids would be like cortisol, okay, coming from the adrenal gland, testosterone, male sex hormone. Here's estradiol, female sex hormone. These are all related to each other. You can see there's just very simple substitutions between maybe one or two groups in the basic molecule, all right, which is cholesterol. So what can you tell me about cholesterol? Good molecule or bad in your body? Bad, yes, it is bad. If what? It's at too high concentration. But if you're completely devoid of cholesterol, you can't make cortisol, can't make testosterone, can't make estradiol, or numerous other kinds of important steroids and sex hormones, and nobody would agree to that. Okay, so you got to have just the right amount, but not too much. All right, so those are steroids. Prostaglandins are also lipids. Okay, here we have a long hydrocarbon chain right here. And here is what group is this? You'll have to tell me by next time. The COOH is a carboxyl group, which makes this an acid. And this is a long fatty chain right here. So this is actually a fatty acid, but it's not long and linear. What has happened to it? It's formed this little hairpin turn right here. And so these are prostaglandins that are built from fatty acids. And these are important signaling molecules in your body. So they help maintain homeostasis because they can signal various tissues to do different things at different times. So prostaglandins are fatty acids, right? They're produced by most tissues and they have many regulatory functions. Oh, it's a very, very diverse group of activity that these prostaglandins can do. But you should at least know that they're derived from fatty acids. Now, what is the molecule that testosterone is derived from? Estradiol is derived from? The basic molecule is cholesterol. Prostaglandins are derived from fatty acids. Okay, so they're sometimes important for structure, sometimes they're important for signaling compounds. All right, so that's going to take us to proteins. I can say just a couple things about proteins. What's the basic building block of polysaccharide? a monosaccharide, right? And you have a couple names now of some specific monosaccharides like glucose, galactose, fructose. What's the building block of a triglyceride? Three fatty acids, and they could be different fatty acids, and glycerol, that three-carbon molecule, okay? Now, what's the building block of a protein? Amino acid. Okay, so what kind of group it makes an organic molecule acidic? Yeah, carboxyl. So here is an amino acid. So it's an acid because we see a nice carboxyl group. Here's a hydrocarbon chain. On the other end, here we see an amino group. All right, so here is a really good example of what? An amino acid, because that's just how it's all put together. Here is a symmetrical carbon in an amino acid. This R right here, you can't really find on the periodic table on this side of the room, but it signifies that at this position, there are a whole host of different kinds of chemical compounds that can be substituted for R. It means a variable group. And when the structure of those compounds changes, like we see through here, guess what? The properties of this amino acid change. Sometimes it makes it an acidic group, makes it very reactive. Sometimes it makes it a hydrophobic group. Maybe it makes it a hydrophilic group. All right, so different amino acids can be used for a whole variety of things just by changing this R to different kinds of functional groups. So here we have some amino acids, right? Here's the acid, here's the amino group, which is hydrophobic. And over here, there's even a bigger hydrophobic region. And you're not going to have to know the names of many amino acids in here. Maybe tyrosine a little bit, because that's an essential amino acid. Right? Valine is not an essential amino acid. It means that valine, your body can make. Your body can make valine, but your body cannot make tyrosine. It's an important molecule, but you can't synthesize it. So if you need it, but you can't synthesize it, what happens? You have to have it in your diet, right? And so essential nutrients are nutrients that have to be in your diet. And this is very important because tyrosine is the precursor to many signaling compounds in your body that we call neurotransmitters. So if your diet isn't proper, then there are various neurons that can't communicate with each other because they don't have the neurotransmitter. Then other amino acids like arginine, cysteine, and aspartic acid over here, just to name a couple, are polar, have polar groups right here. So these are the kinds that like to associate with each other or with water. Here's that sulfhydryl group. The sulfhydryl group can actually form a covalent bond with another cysteine amino acid. This hydrogen can come off and form a nice double bond to a neighboring sulfur right here. And so what can you tell me about covalent bonds, strong or weak?
Strong.
Very strong. So this is a way for different parts of a protein or different chains of amino acids to get stuck together very tightly if it forms a disulfide bridge between them, because a double bond, covalent bond will form between different segments of a protein. Okay. So this is where we're going to start next time, with proteins. And we can put amino acids together using that same reaction. What was the reaction that you used to put monosaccharides together? Dehydration synthesis. Guess what? Exact same reaction for putting amino acids together. Dehydration synthesis. And taking amino acids apart would be? Hydrolysis reaction. Right. Okay. All right, so you've worked your pre-lecture reading assignments, the online questions, your exam figures, and I would like for you to show me your pre-lecture reading assignments as you walk in the door, just like your passport. Show me that you're working on those. And the sign-in sheet I also need. Where's the sign-in sheet at? Over here. Oh, that's as far as it's gone? Holy cow. Carbonyl group. So aldehyde and ketone, just going to be a carbonyl. Hydroxyl, yeah. Phosphate group, carboxyl group, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Oh, you guys have had a chemistry, like a biochemistry class? That's nice. Okay. Hi.
Would you mind putting your dog down?
Sure.